But given the reported edge of something like 20-1 of your college young Republicans over your college young Democrats, I wasn't absolutely certain just how many real Democrats had been picked as delegates. But it occurred to me that even as mock Democrats, this particular mock convention has developed such a reputation for authenticity nationally that I am sure all of the participants, including Mayor Phillips, and all of the delegates properly signed the required pledges not to support anyone opposing a Democratic nominee this fall. So maybe we've got you, if only temporarily. And I can't help but note a comment attributed to your convention political director and credentials chairman, Jack Dent, who has an impressive Republican pedigree if he decides to affiliate. A story a couple of days ago in the Roanoke Times says some of the young Republicans have gotten hooked on Democratic politics. And sometimes it seems to be more than just an intellectual enterprise. The article then quotes Jack as saying, and I quote, "It's almost like they'd vote for one of those guys in the fall." But he then adds, "Once you research it, it kind of opens your mind a little." Well, Jack, if you happen to be right on that particular point, this could be a pretty radical convention. You know the old cliche about a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. But of course, knowledge is an important part of the great WNL tradition. Washington and Lee has sent us many great statesmen, not too many Democrats, admittedly, but lots of leaders from the other side of the aisle. In addition to its list of elected officials, you've also turned out a number of students on the political process, including our own Charlie McDowell and Roger Mudd. In fact, anyone who now hopes to be President of the United States must henceforth pass two tests. They must survive an interview with Roger Mudd, and then they must win the mock convention here at Washington Lee. I come here with a great appreciation for the political tradition and the participants who have been a part of this process over the last 76 or 80 years. I'm reminded, as you must be at least on an annual basis, if not more often, of Alvin Barkley, who spoke at your mock convention in April 30th of 1956, having extolled the virtues of the U.S. Senate over the labors of the vice presidency, he then died on the spot. Maybe that's the reason a lot of folks in Virginia won't run for the U.S. Senate. While I would associate myself with Senator Barkley's remarks, I certainly hope that I won't share his fate. Let me commend you, if I may, for the seriousness of your purpose. I know that on a today like today, most of you would otherwise be in the library while the cadets at VMI are down at Goshen Pass. I understand the tremendous sacrifice that you're making, and I want you to know the Commonwealth appreciates it as well. Now, since my schedule unfortunately requires me to be in Roanoke by 2:55 this afternoon, and I am not going to be able to remain for the major address on behalf of the Democratic Party by my friend Fritz Hollings, I would like to commend this convention for choosing him. In my judgment, you could not have done better. Not only was he one of the most respected governors the South has ever produced, he has become one of the most effective and respected senators ever to serve in the United States Senate. and he has a message that I wish that more of my fellow Americans could hear and understand. Speaking of understanding, if more people could understand him, he might be headed for San Francisco as our party's nominee. But those of you who haven't heard him will understand what I'm talking about in just a couple of minutes. But this whole process, as you know, gets started in Iowa and New Hampshire. And there just aren't that many people who understand, much less speak Southern in either of those states. So he was at a big disadvantage. Now, if only he'd spent just a little more money and hired an interpreter or a translator, there's no telling where his campaign might be right now. Well, speaking of process, and on a brief, more serious note, the democratic process that sustains and renews self-government, as Winston Churchill once observed, may in fact be the most exasperating, perplexing, cumbersome, and even infuriating jumble of fluctuating events known in the experience of any culture. But it is just as surely, as Churchill believed, by far the best and the most important political system ever devised, by far the greatest hope for the future of the world and the triumph of human dignity. There simply has been nothing else like it, nothing else that even comes close to it in the experience of free men. Moreover, the seriousness of purpose that characterizes everything about this convention, the attention to detail, the reliance upon the latest and most reliable techniques in gathering political data, the faithful replication of the delegate selection procedures, however unintelligible, and the enthusiastic duplication of the freewheeling atmosphere of a real national party convention, except there weren't any demonstrations outside when I came in like we might find in San Francisco. The combination of these things in the experience of this convention will be, I think, literally invaluable. The experience that you have here should give you a short course in education and the realities of the American political process, perhaps as good or better than you'll find any place else in this country. During the next 2 days, I hope you'll apply as objectively and thoughtfully as you can your knowledge, your talents, and your energies to a full and open debate of the issues, to a thorough assessment of the strengths and positions of the candidates for our presidential nomination. In addition, I would hope you could also devote your discussions toward the development of a common view or vision for the future direction of the Democratic Party and for our country. These considerations, I believe, represent the most important elements that can and should be incorporated into a national party selection of its standard bearer. They are the considerations that I am confident you will apply to the process here. They are considerations that will undoubtedly make your selection of the nominee an accurate prediction of who will emerge from the convention in San Francisco as our party's standard bearer. I hope you will work hard. I'm confident you'll have fun. And I'm certain that as you adjourn as a convention, you'll have gained an experience valuable both to yourselves and to the future of our strength as a free nation and to our prospects for continuing renewal as a self-governing society. I will be looking forward with great interest to the results of what you decide here at Washington and Lee. And for the privilege of bringing greetings to this important convention, I wish you good luck, Godspeed, and I thank you.
Carolina crowd back there. Yeah. Thank you very much. There you go. Mixing's one. Mr. Chairman, Governor Robb, President Wilson, Mayor Phillips, Congressman Olin, my fellow Democrats. This isn't a Democratic convention, this is a Republican ambush. I came into my headquarters running for re-election in 1980, and my campaign manager said, you better get on up there to Greenville. They're telling a pack of lies about you up there. I said, heck, man, I got to get down to Charleston first where they're telling the truth about me. I appreciate my good friend, Mr. Likes, and his over-generous introduction. And I do appreciate very, very genuinely the chance at this experience. The truth is, I used to have to cancel special engagements in order to make a meeting of this kind. Now special engagements have canceled me, and I'm glad to be invited anywhere. It was Thomas Wolfe who said, I can't go home again. I've just proved that. I've not only come home, but the New Hampshire voters insisted on it. I learned there that when E.F. Holling spoke, nobody listened. In fact, as Governor Robb indicated, those who tried couldn't understand. I knocked on one door up there in Manchester, New Hampshire, said I was Fritz Hollings. They thought it was a German trucking company. I've learned something from my friend Gary Hart. I'm going to change my name to Fritz Hall the next race. Governor Robb, I thought about taking lessons in order to get rid of this Virginia, South Carolina accent. And I thought of those two secretaries of state, Kissinger and Haig. And I realized that the one with the accent was the one that you could understand. We did have one high, bright, shining moment during the campaign. It was after the Dartmouth debate, this very charming lady rushed up and said, Senator, that was brilliant. That was just a magnificent performance. You'll win the vote of every thinking person in this audience. I said, Madam, that's not enough. We need a majority. But let me get right to the point for us Democrats. I want to win in November. I have attended, and this is a magnificent convention, and I guess I've been to a good 2 to 3 dozen in the past year. We've had straw polls and conventions in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Maine, Iowa, all the way around. And you see the color, you see the enthusiasm. You see the Democrats with the high ground on all the real sort of meaningful issues as we see them. We have the high ground on the matter of civil rights, women's rights, housing, urban development, education, women's infants and children's feeding, arms control. You can go right on down the litany. And we take that high ground and then come back and look at the poll like they had in Michigan last week. And the Michigan poll showed that Ronald Reagan had 55%, and the present leader of the Democratic ticket, Vice President Mondale, had 35%. We have had that high ground on those issues for the past three out of four races, and yet we've lost the last three out of four races. And the reason is because we don't address the economic and the number one issue in our land. As Democrats, we frighten the American people on managing the economy. In 1968, there's no question in my mind we Democrats had the better man. In Hubert Humphrey, the high ground on arms control, civil rights, the social issues. But my friend Hubert was perceived as a spender, frightening the American people, and we reincarnated. I see a sign out here about Nixon. One more time, now more than ever, whatever it is. My friend Governor Pat Brown in California had already run Nixon all the way back over to New York. But we Democrats, we reincarnated Nixon and reelected him in 1972, George McGovern. I was the senatorial campaign chairman that year. We lost a Democratic seat here, Bill Spong in Virginia, because George McGovern was going to mail everybody $1,000. He frightened me, I can tell you that, when he started with his economic program. And so we reelected President Nixon, and in 1980, the only question was, could the economy stand four more years of 12% inflation and 20% interest rates? And as Democrats, having campaigned for a year and a half, drawing down to the wire here in June for our July convention, we've had the television, we've had the enthusiasm, we've had the participation, we've had the issues, and we're still running behind. And I think the time has come for us to talk, as Adlai Stevenson said, let's talk sense to the American people and to ourselves. This country is running $200 billion budget deficits, $100 billion trade deficits, spending $150 billion a year just on interest costs on the national debt. So that when at your mock convention I am asked, are you better off than what you were 4 years ago, spending $200 billion more than I'm taking in? My generation says, that's right, yes, yes, that's right, that's right. But you at this convention are going to have to pick up my bill. I don't care what record you make here at Washington and Lee. You're going to have to pay for my provocacy, my extravagance, my failure to pay the bills. Last week, rather than just talk about it, I feel good that we presented a plan in the United States Senate to just extend this year's 1984 fiscal budget for 1985. Just extend it 1 year. No increases, no cuts. We save $75 billion, and if we hold a tax picture it, the same thing, tie with the board, we pick up $100 billion. We had the majority of Democrats in the United States Senate, plus 12 Republicans, support that over the calls from President Reagan, from Air Force One in opposition to the plan, over the opposition of Majority Leader Baker on the floor, and the opposition of the minority Leader Byrd on the floor of the United States Senate. We still had a majority of those Democrats. Why? Because the people, you, out in the boondocks, the highways, the byways, the main streets, the farms of America, realize that this charade has got to stop. So between now, my fellow Democrats, here in May and November, still as candidates, rather than talking about where we're going to put the embassy in Israel or where the red telephone is in the White House, I think if I got there, they'd tell me where the phone was. I would hope that rather than to wrangle about PACs and all of these other things, that we come back home and talk to the American people on what they're interested in, what they're concerned with, and on the very point that we, not they won, we elected Republicans the last 3 out of 4 times. We're going to lose 4 out of 5 unless we change it. And I say that very genuinely. And let's put a net on Ronald Reagan. You know, President Reagan is not the great communicator. He came to Washington, I'll just take one example, started with the litany with respect to foreign policy of invading El Salvador, blockading Cuba. Yes, there was such a thing as limited nuclear war. We may fire a warning nuclear shot. And the next thing you know, 700,000 Americans spilled onto Main Street, New York, Fifth Avenue. They weren't frightened by Brezhnev. They were frightened by our own president. He called them, the Soviets, cheaters and liars, the evil empire, and thereby poisoned the well in foreign policy, in arms control, in relations with our allies in Europe, and now with the Olympic Games. It's going right on down. He has communicated the wrong signals. And we are in a tenuous situation. Certain it is, he's not amnesiac. My friend, the Vice President Mondale, said that Ronald Reagan was amnesiac. He's not amnesiac, he's intentional, and we Democrats better understand it. You see, President Reagan comes from the Wild West with that frontier mentality. He pals around with that little kitchen cabinet of his, the former Justin Dodd, Holmes Tuttle, Ed Meese, Walter Annenberg, and that crowd. He doesn't believe in women. He doesn't believe, I don't see you do either. I knew this was a Republican conspiracy, isn't it? That's their age. He doesn't believe in children. He doesn't believe in minorities. Ronald Reagan believes in an eternal present. And he thinks his mission in life is to come east onto the Potomac and dismantle that mammoth federal bureaucracy, the national government. He thinks that's exactly what we need. And so he comes with his federalism program. Send it back to the city, send it back to the states. Can't get rid of it that way. Give it to Ann Gorsuch. She'll get rid of the environment. Give the interior to James Watt. He'll get rid of the interior. He was selling all the national parks, the coal reserves. Even my Republican friends. My Republican friends had to stop selling the coal reserves for a penny a ton in the United States Senate. Put in from my state of South Carolina, Governor Edwards, a tooth dentist. As the Secretary of Energy, I hereby swear to abolish the Energy Department. Put in bail, I hereby swear to abolish the Education Department. Get rid of the legal services, women's, infants, and children's feeding, education, and all the different housing programs. Just get rid of it. Well, let me disabuse those who cheer. For one thing, Ronald Reagan's memory of history is very, very faulty. That frontier that he thinks it was developed without Social Security and food stamps and welfare, and if we've done it before, we can do it again. The truth of the matter is, here in Virginia, after we in 76 were celebrating our 200th anniversary, you had celebrated your 350th. And having tried for 150 years without a federal government on that Potomac, you mutually, and we all pledged each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. A declaration of independence, yes, but more to me, a declaration of dependence. And in this day and age of international competition, where in agriculture now we are into a competitive mold with respect to anything produced in the factories here in Virginia, It's on the international market. With respect to the human infrastructure, building up our youngsters in education, we need, in this decade of the 80s, a federal government more than any. I'm not talking about a mammoth bureaucracy. I'm not talking about incompetence and waste in the Pentagon. I'm not talking about spend, tax. I would remind my friends and fellow Democrats that we as Democrats did manage that economy with a discipline. If you took all of the deficits from 1947 up to 1980 for 33 years, all of those deficits amount to $465.5 billion, in contrast to the deficits of the 3 years, 82, 83, and 84. Those three-year deficits amount to $495 billion. It hadn't been the Democratic Congresses of spend and span, but on the contrary of this administration, the Reaganomics of taking the increased revenues from decreased taxes and increasing defense, economic quackery if there ever was one, mortgaging the future of our generation and dissembling and dismantling our federal government. And so the job for us as Democrats is to face up to realism and remember that people who say they don't trust politicians anymore are waiting for politicians who will behave as though they trust the people. Now is the time to talk sense, because we can't afford four more years of the disinvestment and the dismantlement of the Reagan administration. Yes, we may have needed to hold back some of the spending, but we can't have the dismantlement in this age in which we live. And it'll come about through a sacrifice, not necessarily just a coalition of different and disparate pressure in interest groups. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, 50 years ago, looked out upon a land, economic ruin, and turned it into an economic giant that saved the freedom the world around. Some think he did it through the dint of his personality, or the alphabet agencies he put in to solve problems, or the correlation politically of disparate political groups. But I rather feel, my fellow Democrats, that he did it by calling on the inner reserves of the American people. These reserves, when we use them, these reserves as deep pools that reinforce and strengthen our vision, bring us as a family into one, into a community of spirit working with a unity of purpose. And this is the call of the hour in 1984 if we're going to win that White House back again. We don't have to look far for those reserves. We suffered the agony of Pearl Harbor and then conquered the dictatorships. We saw Europe in ruins and then rebuilt it with the Marshall Plan. We watched communism on the march and then moved to halt it. We were challenged by Sputnik and then won the race to the moon. We were overwhelmed by racial discrimination and then dismantled its structure. And we retreated before the onslaught of air and water pollution, and then we moved to turn them back. Not any magic or magical set of new ideas or cluster of all-powerful interest groups, but hard work, sacrifice. We have in this land the human ingenuity, the scientific imagination, the industrial muscle, and the financial resources, and the enthusiasm to compete. Whenever we sacrifice together and work together, and pull together, there's no force on earth that can stop us. And this is the message for our Democratic Party to take over in November. If we can make the call for sacrifice and prove our capacity to govern, then come November, once again, as heralded by a young president, can we have not just a victory of party, but a celebration of freedom, symbolizing a beginning as well as an end, signifying renewal as well as change. Thank you very much.
All delegates remain seated, please. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Senator Hollings for those fine and considerate remarks. As temporary chairman of this convention, I would like to offer my thanks to those many people who I have been fortunate enough to work with during the past 2 years. I speak especially to the members of the steering committee and the state chairman. These individuals have worked long and hard to make this event possible, and it has been a pleasure to be associated with people like these, and I am indeed grateful. It is now time to conduct the first actual piece of business of this convention, the report of the Committee on Credentials. The chairman of that committee is Mr. Jack Dent, who also serves as political director of the steering committee and is delegated from New Jersey. Jack?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, my fellow delegates and distinguished guests. I am pleased to report to you on the Credentials Committee of the 1984 Democratic Convention. Because I've stuck my foot in my mouth many times during the pre-convention, I will limit my remarks. The Credentials Committee is charged with responsibility for resolving questions concerning the seating of delegates to the convention.
Let's give our speaker some attention.
Approximately 15 credentials challenges were received by the Credentials Committee. These challenges were resolved quickly through negotiation between the committee and the state chairman. My fellow delegates, I now move for adoption of the report of the Credentials Committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jack. You've heard the motion. Is there a second? Is there any further debate? Those in favor of accepting the Credentials Committee report signify by saying aye. Those opposed, no. The ayes have it, and the report of the Committee on Credentials is adopted. We We now move to the report of the Committee on Rules. To deliver that committee's report, the chair recognizes the chairman of the Rules Committee, Mr. Lee Feldman, executive director of the Steering Committee, and delegate from Pennsylvania. Lee.
Mr. Chairman, on behalf of the Rules Committee of this convention, the most interesting committee of this convention, I am honored to move for the adoption of the permanent procedural rules of the 1984 mock Democratic Convention. Fellow delegates, you have found these rules in your packets, and I'm sure they've been interesting reading. They're pretty much self-explanatory, but we should go ahead and point to our parliamentarian, Mr. Tilley and Mr. Eyrig, who you should refer any questions to. They'll also be keeping the time. The drawing for vice presidential nominations tomorrow will be held at 11 a.m. All those submitting nominations should be up here at the podium. Petitions are due at that time. Thank you very much.
Is there a second to the motion for adoption? Is there any further discussion? Hearing no further discussion, it is time to vote. Those in favor of accepting the report of the Committee on Rules signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The ayes have it. The ayes have it, and the committee's report is adopted. And now the chair will entertain a motion to adjourn until 8 p.m. tonight. I'm not through yet. You can't get rid of me that quick. The chair recognizes the chairman of the Connecticut delegation, Mr. Foster Friedman. Mr. Chairman of Connecticut.